Hello, and welcome to Radio New Internationalist. Each week in this program, New Internationalists from around the world explore the people, the ideas, and the action in the fight for global justice. In a moment, campaigners from Africa, Europe, the Pacific Islands and Australia will start dropping in. They'll be bringing us stories of hope that are too often missed by mainstream media. A world without armies, trade without greed, and building communities that connect. I'm Chris Richards from New Internationalist magazine. They say that people in the media like me have short memories, that journalists and editors dump the very problems that they help to reveal. So last week and this week, the Radio New Internationalist team thought it would be valuable to look back over some of the big issues of 2007, issues that are set to get even bigger in the next few years. This week, the two issues that have been, and in our view will continue to dominate the international social justice agenda, conflict and climate change. You know the problems. There isn't a media outlet that you listen to that isn't regularly reporting on them. So our guests today will be opening the doors in these debates that are too often closed. Issues like practicing peace. Except for Antarctica, there isn't a continent on the planet that's not greatly affected by major armed conflict. No wonder that a world without armies may sound impossible. Yet, last time New Internationalists looked, a staggering 28 nations had no armies. Academic and author Professor Johan Galtung is a pioneer of resolving disputes through non-violence. We talked with him last February about what kind of country can successfully ditch its armed forces.
If you look at Latin America, where Costa Rica is the famous example, one should be aware of one thing, that traditionally the armies in Latin America have been used for coup d'etat and not for fighting between countries. There are exceptions, certainly, like Paraguay with its neighboring countries, Ecuador, but Costa Rica, I think, was in that category. Then you have a number of small countries, but they're all important. And what is interesting is that they don't seem to have been attacked, in spite of the fact that they don't have, or because of the fact that they don't have armies.
Yes. Well, let's take a case study here. What about Panama? How did it go about getting rid of its army, Johan?
You see, Panama and Haiti are both interesting, and Arias played a major role. I think in Panama, one has to be aware of the role of Torrijos, who was the president. And he had been pressured by U.S. in very many different ways. And one way of not submitting to a pressure is simply to get rid of the army. You see, the point is that armies in Latin American countries are very often used by the United States as a control instrument. And that was the case in Panama and case in Haiti. So one way of loosening the tie to the United States is simply to get rid of the army. So that case is different from Costa Rica. And I think when you look at the various cases, you will find different explanations varying from country to country.
Hmm. I suppose over $1 trillion was spent on militaries worldwide in 2004. With figures like this, another element comes into it, doesn't it, which is global capitalism. Can global capitalism afford for the world to lay down its arms?
Can the US afford not to have it is perhaps an even more important question.
Indeed.
If you look at US export, arms is a very sizable factor in it. You can ask yourself, where in Europe do you find anybody driving an American car? And the answer will probably be nowhere, almost. And you can ask yourself, do you find a NATO country which doesn't have predominantly U.S. arms? And again, the answer is no. By and large, they do, with some few exceptions. Not by that saying that the U.S. is alone. The five veto power countries have, if I'm not wrong, more than 95% of the arms trade.
One of your students, now President Oscar Arias Sanchez of Costa Rica, supported two countries to demilitarize, the two countries you've already mentioned, Panama and Haiti. Both are small nations. So how realistic is this model for larger countries, Johan?
Difficult to tell. It would be very useful if one had an intermediate stage. Namely, the point is actually not so much for a country not to have an army, but not to have an offensive, provocative army. In other words, retooling to non-provocative, defensive defense might actually do the trick to a large extent. And that is where Switzerland used to be. And that means, by and large, to abstain from long-range weapons, to abstain from the capacity to bomb the civilian population, kill the civilian population on the other side, and simply be more like a hedgehog, so to speak, saying, okay, attack me. You'll get a very, very warm reception, but I'm not going to attack you.
I'm wondering how realistic that is, though. So, for instance, we're speaking with a journalist in Somalia in this program, and we're talking about Ethiopia and Somalia and the fact that the US is backing Ethiopian conflict. For Somalia to lay down its arms after a history of conflict that goes back decades is an extremely difficult thing for a country in terms of its psyche to do when it's actually in war mode. How do you get around the problem that these are communities that have relied on guns and used guns for so many decades?
I would say that we are not only dealing with an army of the so-called provisional government, which may be a non-government, we are dealing with several armed factions of the population. And I would tend to say in this case, the only approach is to try to solve the conflict. Mm. And to solve the conflict means to start with the U.S. to do something they are not trained in doing and have to learn to do, and that is to negotiate, have dialogue, have contact with the people they call fundamentalists. I know a lot of them in many countries, and I found them very, very easy people to have dialogue with, and it's very clear what they stand for, and not nothing particularly problematic in most cases. So that's one point. Another point, which some people have mentioned, is that maybe time has come, instead of Eritrea, Ethiopia, Somalia, and let us add Djibouti, where the American bases are, to be at war with each other. Ogaden, of course, is the prime example, and the invasion in December, the other one, the U.S. supported Ethiopian invasion. How about a confederation? How about some kind of community, the Horn of Africa community? I know that a leading Somali politician has been thinking in that direction, and I find that so much more important and much more realistic as a way of thinking. The sizable Muslim minority in Ethiopia, for instance, of course, Coptic Christianity is the official faith, but the basis for coming together instead of being apart and being at perennial war should be present.
Johan,
and that applies to all the three parts of Somalia at present.
Johan, another theory is that the international community could link aid dollars to a country's enthusiasm to give up its guns. How practical do you think this is as an option?
Well, the kind of bargaining where you say you do this and you get that is usually not working very well. There is a kind of insult in dignity. Mm. And a much better approach is for anything to come from the inside. That doesn't mean that outsiders, including myself, cannot at times suggest something. But the basic master of whatever change has to be the people themselves.
Indeed. Johan, I'd like to bring into the conversation now Ahmed Abdisalam Adan from Somalia, from a media outlet called Horn Afrique. Ahmed, what do you think of this idea of a non-violent, way of resolving the conflict in your country at the moment, of actually bringing together the three areas of the Horn of Africa and living as one community?
I think the idea is very good. First of all, the basis of the nonviolence is something that's built in the traditional systems, in the indigenous systems of the Somali people. Even throughout the 15 years of the conflict and without the state here, the traditional elders and the community leaders have been actively engaged in resolving conflicts in a nonviolent way. They have been attempting to do that. So that, at one point, is a noble idea. The issue of a unified Horn of Africa is a good idea, actually. It's admirable. I mean, the world is coming together. NAFTA, the North American Free Trade is coming together. The Europeans are coming together. So there's no reason why the Horn of Africa cannot come together. But the problem is every other group decided to do that on the basis of a clear economic, political, and social integration. Here it seems in the Horn of Africa, there is disintegration now. What you have is Somalia now being divided into small enclaves. So maybe if we first have to be into small groups before we come together. I think we need political leaders, we need some stability and some development. And so that our people are suffering now. And if we have some level of stability, then it's easy for the political leaders to look at options for integration. What can we bring together? The problem is our energy, our resources, our time, everything now is spent on the conflict.
Mm.
Eritrea, Ethiopia, Somalia, Ethiopia, within Somalia, within Ethiopia, within Eritrea, everyone. And so that whole horn is in a kind of very difficult conflict. So I think we need a period of stability before we start to look at ways of coming together. And then using our strength in a form of integration to make focus on trade, on economic partnerships, on taking advantage of the large population that we have in the region. But now, apart from just the idea, it's very, very difficult to even discuss that, because the minute you raise that issue now in Somalia, it's simply seen as Ethiopia taking over Somalia. Anyone who raised that, I think one of our ministers here, the other day raised that in the media, the level of suspicion and people making very, very angry comments about the minister's comments.
Yes.
So I hope to see that day when we can talk about what is the strength of each group here and each part in this conflict and what can we bring together.
Johan, the culture of war is quite different to the culture of peace. How long would it take for a country to move into a position where they can not only talk but hear what each other is saying?
Well, you see, I listened with great admiration to what Ahmed said and agreed with everything except one little point. He said that before we can look at such things, we have to come to grips with the present situation. And I would say do it at the same time. I think it was Hussein Aidid who actually mentioned the idea of a Horn of Africa community, and he is a minister, and the son of Mohammed Aidid, if I'm not wrong. And I think also that the non-violence that Ahmed referred to is very much tied to the ancient Somali pattern of Shir, S-H-I-R, which is an admirable conflict transformation, unknown in the West. And I would say probably in general much better than adjudication in the Western form. So why not have not a governmental but some kind of non-governmental reach out to people in the other areas, a kind of informal coming together of people who could try to put together what such a community would look like so that the vision could take some form without involving and implying governments and ministers.
Ahmed?
Yeah, I think the culture of peace is a necessary step. I think that's very important. When the political leaders of these countries are at war, it's very difficult for civic leaders and civic societies to come together and talk about peace. The entire communities are already involved, all our energies, whether we are civil society, community leaders, peace activists, we are all now putting out fires. And so it's important for each community to instill this culture of peace before we can bring that together.
That was a most illuminating conversation. Thank you both.
Thanks indeed. Thank you, Ahmed.
That was Johan Galtung, a founder and director of Transcend, a network for peace and development. Check it out at www.transcend.org. He was exchanging views with Ahmed Abdeslam Adan, who was at the time we spoke with him last February running a radio station in a war zone, Horn Afrique Media in Somalia. Listening to Radio New Internationalist. Yay! I'm Chris Richards, sitting in community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. And today we're talking about peace. With the amount of global conflict at the moment, you'd reckon that peace would be the most talked about thing in town. So why isn't it? One reason seems to be that there's more money in war than there is in peace, something that we explored last year in a program called The Next Western Front. With war now an entrenched part of the global economy, private and public armies need conflict to survive. Damien Kingsbury studies this phenomenon in Indonesia. He's written and edited a number of books, including Power, Politics and the Indonesian Military. Last October, he told us how around 70% of the income needed by the Indonesian military to operate comes from providing security to private companies. Companies like these ones.
The Indonesian military provides security to a number of organisations, largely companies, large companies very often, transnationals, particularly in places like West Papua, where there's huge amounts of money to be made and where the companies believe that they need some sort of security because there is some sort of local independence movement or some sort of expression of local concern with some of their activities. Now, the companies more recently have hired protection through security companies, but the security companies then go and hire police or soldiers to work for them, even though they're still employed as police or soldiers.
So what do they want the army to do when they hire them for these contracts?
Well, the army essentially provides protection in the classical sense of a standover organisation. That is, you may say that you don't need protection, but if you don't, then the army or the police makes sure that you do.
Yeah, when I was reporting from West Papua, which is currently a western province of Indonesia, the Indonesian army, the TNI, attracted a lot of criticism for providing security to illegal logging operations. It wasn't just that they were supporting illegal logging that was attracting criticism either. It was, as you said, their penchant for fueling conflict to actually convince their clients that their presence, their guns, were needed. I mean, how common is that?
Well, that's very common in places like West Papua. They can foment trouble or disturbance, they can hire thugs, indeed they often engage in troublemaking themselves. In West Papua in particular, we saw with Freeport a few years ago now, when the United States introduced new legislation around financial transparency of its companies following the Enron collapse, what we saw with Freeport is it said to the TNI, look, we can't be sending you money under the desk, so to speak. We have to stop those arrangements. So it's been nice, fellas, but the show's over. What we saw very soon after that was an attack on American school teachers, in which two school teachers were killed. Now, that crime has never been actually solved, but the widespread belief is that the TNI was behind it, and it was actually a lesson to Freeport to say, well, look, you do need our protection. You still have to pay up. What's changed since then is that the companies like Freeport no longer pay directly to the military or to the police. What they do is they hire security companies, and these security companies then hire the police or hire the military to work for them in exactly the same capacity, which very often means no capacity at all. But there's an implicit understanding amongst big companies in Indonesia that you do have to pay a proportion of your profits to the military and to the police just to ensure that things go along smoothly, an extra tax that you have to pay to do business in Indonesia.
Mm. And what about other conflict zones? I'm thinking about Aceh, for instance. Are there similar stories coming out of Aceh about that type of phenomenon?
Certainly. The TNI didn't have any business interests directly in Aceh, as it still does in West Papua, particularly in logging and resource extraction, transport and so on. But the TNI did make an awful lot of money out of illegal businesses, gun running, drugs, smuggling, and of course its protection rackets, which were widespread. Now, with the signing of the peace agreement in Aceh, the number of military in Aceh has been cut by about half, maybe a bit more than half. So consequently, we've seen a decline in those types of businesses, but they still do exist. The Indonesian military is only funded to about a quarter to a third of its needs by the government, so it really does have to make up the difference through its private business activities and very often through criminal activities.
I mean, how does that work? Does that mean that they're not given enough money to actually pay the wages of the people they employ?
Well, yes, Indonesian soldiers are very poorly paid. There are subsidies given to them which actually help resolve the problem with the lack of actual cash in terms of housing, education for their children and so on. But again, there's not enough money to go around. So what happens is you find that the income that's earned from other business activities or very often from illegal activities actually goes towards paying for these other goods and services. If, for example, the total budget for the Indonesian military was, say, $6 billion a year, only about $1.5 or $1.6 billion of that would actually come from the Indonesian government. The rest is made up from income from private businesses that the military actually owns or through its black market activities.
Mm. I suppose Indonesia's not the only army that has to rely on private contracts, though. Can you give us a bit of a rundown of other Asian armies that have to turn to other income sources to keep operating, Damien?
Yeah, look, it's a common phenomena in post-colonial or post-revolutionary environments where what was the guerrilla army or the revolutionary army was not able to be provided for by the government-to-be of the new state. So they essentially had to provide for themselves, and that was very often through illegal methods, smuggling, businesses and so on. In Vietnam, we see the Vietnamese military is still engaged very deeply in a range of businesses. In Laos, it's a major economic player. In Cambodia, of course, the military is still a very big economic player, although it's been reduced somewhat and largely now is confined to illegal activities, particularly illegal logging, gem mining and smuggling and so on. Of course, in Burma, we see the military dominates, indeed runs the state, and the state exists essentially to support the military. The military owns the biggest businesses in Burma, so that's the most outstanding example. In Thailand, the military still owns banks, television stations, radio stations, a newspaper, and other businesses. So again, we see the military subsidising itself through a range of private sources. And of course, what this means is the extent to which a military is self-financing is the extent to which a government has no civil control over military function, because it doesn't have the opportunity to say, well, if you don't do what we say, we'll cut off the money.
Yes, that's a significant problem. I'm wondering what other problems communities face as a consequence of this interplay.
Well, of course, when you get militaries engaging in business, particularly in the more questionable ends of business, where they become so-called grey businesses like protection rackets or indeed the black market, smuggling, gambling, prostitution and so on, what you see is a business that's essentially run by people with guns. Now, when you have an illegal business run by people with guns, that can only be described as a variation on the theme of the mafia. It's very big, it's relatively highly organised, it has a hierarchy, a very distinct structure, and it's deeply embedded in the state. And that, of course, is profoundly problematic, not just for the economic development of the state, but for its political development in terms of democratic institutions, representation, and, of course, human rights.
And I suppose the entrenchment of corruption might figure in there too when we're talking about these types of enterprises?
Oh, almost by definition. Of course, when there's money involved, and particularly when you're talking about grey or illegal activities, of course, there's a great deal of corruption. About two-thirds of the Indonesian military's income would actually come from black sources, that is, illegal sources. So by definition, it's involving a high level of corruption amongst the military hierarchy, payoffs, patron-client relations, and so on.
Mm. Damien, I'm wondering about the reaction of the Indonesian government itself to this real problem with military funding. Is there any shift toward actually finding the money to pay the military out of government coffers?
The Indonesian government has passed legislation, I think now 3 years ago or so, to say that all military businesses should be handed over to the government and that the military should divest itself. Now, there's a couple of problems with this, one of which is that no regulations to enact the legislation have been passed, and hence, essentially, nothing in that regard has yet happened. The other problem, of course, is that the legal businesses probably provide only about one-third of the Indonesian military's private income. The rest comes from illegal sources, and, of course, there's no way of saying, well, you have to hand over your illegal businesses, because the military, of course, says, well, they don't exist. Now, even if the military hands over its legal businesses, it is still going to retain its range of illegal activities, and they, of course, are the most problematic. The other side of it is the Indonesian government could pay for the Indonesian military in its entirety, but that would stretch an already fairly tight budget. Part of the problem here, though, is that there's a very widespread belief that if the Indonesian government did actually increase the direct funding to the military, that would end up only as a subsidy and would actually just add to the total pool of income available rather than replacing part of that income. So there's a deep structural problem here, and I think it's going to take a significant cultural shift within the Indonesian military to finally resolve it.
That was Associate Professor Damian Kingsbury from the School of International and Political Studies at Deakin University. He's written and edited a number of books. His latest is Political Development, published by Routledge this year. That was illuminating. Damian, thanks very much for being part of the program today.
My pleasure.
Bye for now.
Okay, speak to you later. Bye-bye.
Was Bob Brosman performing Scar Waltz Train on his latest CD, Lumiere. More details about that later in the program. You're listening to Radio New Internationalist, coming to you through radios, computers, and iPods around the world, like the one you're listening to now. And if you want to hear the perspectives of any of today's guests again, or you've missed the earlier parts of this program, just jump onto your computer and visit the New Internationalist website, www.newint.org. Then click on Radio New Internationalist. I'm Chris Richards, and today we're looking back over some of the big issues of 2007, issues that are set to get even bigger in the next few years, like climate change. If you're getting concerned about the level of water in your community because of climate change at the moment, spare a moment for the Carteret Islanders, who live on the islands off Papua New Guinea in the Pacific Ocean. Their present homes are likely to be largely submerged by the year 2015. Last October, Ursula Rakova and Bernard Toonham dropped into the studio to tell us about what's happening on the island where they live. Bernard went first.
I have been working with the communities in the Carteret, and all the time we are feeling insecure. We are living in fear because of this rising of sea level. It's eating away the shorelines on the island, and the waves have virtually come in to areas we've been planting swamp taro and whatever we could plant on the island, and virtually we've lost all that. And all the time we are asking ourselves, for how long are we going to survive? Because at any time we could be hit by a tidal wave. At the moment the situation is so extreme, very critical, and the people can no longer wait for assistance coming, because we have been waiting and asking when the autonomous government of Bougainville, nor the Papua New Guinea government going to help us. We could be able to move our people to safer ground on the mainland of Bougainville.
I'd like to explore that issue a little bit later in the interview. I'm first wanting to paint a picture for our friends who are listening about what's actually happening on the island itself. Ursula Rakova, if I can bring you into our conversation now, tell us about life in your village at the moment. You have no cars, you have no electricity, your food supplies are brought forward through agriculture and fishing, is that right?
Chris, when we're talking about food security, we have nothing that we can call food security any longer on Carteret. We have lost our staple food crop, which was swamp taro. We can no longer grow swamp taro because salt water has killed swamp taro, which was our main staple diet. In terms of agriculture and cash income, we do not have that. Our only source of income comes from beach steamer or sea cucumbers, and that's very irregular. And it basically can go to families who can dive deeper into the sea to get sea cucumbers for sale.
So you're losing crops. How are your homes being affected?
Badly, because the level of the island is 1.7 meters above sea level. So when the waves come in, they just went through houses, and we have no way to sleep except to wait when it's dried up. We are able to use our houses again.
You raised the question of Bougainville before. I'm wondering, what are you asking of the world at the moment? You're going to be one of the first raft, if you like, of climate change refugees. What assistance are countries around your region and indeed the world offering you at the moment?
Basically, we have been experiencing sea level rise for the last 20 to 30 years. The PNC government has no plan for evacuation of climate change refugees for people like us on Carteret. The Bougainville government also at this stage does not have a plan. They do have draft plans of National Emergency and Disaster Services, but those are still in draft forms. So basically we are asking communities or people around the world to look at situations that people like us on the Carteret are facing. It is not only the Carteret that is going or being submerged underwater. There are other communities who are also experiencing similar situations, like the Kiribati, Tuvalu, and even in PNG. They are also experiencing situations like this. But on Carteret, it is extreme. It is at an extreme stage where we can no longer grow our food. We can no longer make gardens because the land is just not conducive for growing food crops anymore.
And what about greenhouse emissions? You said that this problem, Ursula, has been a problem for you for 30 years now. That's a long time. How much of that do you attribute to greenhouse gases and climate change? And will the Carterets be capable of being saved if we take urgent action to reduce greenhouse emissions?
Chris, when I was a small girl, the experiences of sea flowing into the food gardens was not a regular occurrence. Now the sea test goes in, it's a frequent occurrence where we have built sea walls to try to protect the erosion of our shorelines. We have also planted mangroves, but these are nomads for the strong currents that regularly and continuously wash away at our shorelines. This is a situation that is getting worse. And it's getting worse every year. And we attribute this to the rising sea levels that is affecting other nations in the Pacific.
And what about the bigger nations surrounding you? And I'm thinking here of Australia, New Zealand, and indeed some of the Asian nations like Japan, the Philippines. Are they rendering any assistance at all?
We believe that the major players are Australia, America, India, China, all these industrialized countries. At the moment, our people are world first environmental refugees. Where is justice? We are facing something not of our own making, but because others have been burning carbon dioxide or giving this green gas emission. Therefore, we are here purposely to ask if Australia can at least help us and compensate us for the situation we are facing in relation to global warming.
So this is part of greenhouse development rights then, is it? That you are going to lose your country, essentially. You're going to lose your land.
Within 10 to 15 years, according to scientists, our island will be submerged, will be under the water.
And are you looking for another land to go to? A relocation, say, for instance, within Papua New Guinea?
The only option left for our people is to be relocated to the mainland of Bougainville. And we are looking at the tune of 1 to 2 million kina to at least purchase 300 to 700 hectares of land so that all our people would be accommodated in those safer areas on the mainland of Bougainville.
And how much would that cost in US dollars?
In US dollars, it would cost 1 million.
That's actually not a huge amount, is it?
That is not a huge amount, and we are not asking for a grant here. We are basically asking for compensation for what has been lost to us. We are losing our land. We don't drive cars, nor do we have electricity on Carterets. We are basically victims of what the industrialized nations like US, India, Australia, and European nations are contributing to greenhouse effect.
Well, thank you so much for coming into the studio and sharing your stories with us today, and good luck. What you are looking for at the moment, effectively a new life, is something that you well and truly deserve, and I hope that the world responds accordingly. That was Ursula Rakova and Bernard Toonham from the Carteret Islands. Safe travelling, and I hope that you are successful in your claims.
Chris, you have been a blessing to us and to the people of Carteret Island especially.
Why? Moving on.
Hello, Sheila. Bahamarayo. Chica. Chica, she's
was Saba singing the title song from her album Jidka, meaning the line. Saba was born in Mogadishu, the capital of Somalia, to an Ethiopian mother and an Italian father. She says about the song that we've just been listening to, Jidka refers to the line that runs on my belly, which divides it into two parts, a darker side and a whiter one. These strange things happen to mixed blood people like me. This line symbolises, for me, the union of diversities, the example of optimism, confidence and harmony that my parents gave when, against the world, they decided to love each other. Pretty good rendition, isn't it? You're listening to Radio New Internationalist. I'm Chris Richards, sitting in Community Radio 3CR studios in Melbourne, Australia. We're talking about the big issues confronting us in 2008 today, such as climate change, an issue that we'll be returning to throughout this year. But we were delighted last September when Susan George dropped into our airwaves to outline a possible solution to climate change that we weren't hearing anything about. She talked to us from where she lives in France. She's the author of more than a dozen books, many of which have been pivotal in informing and stimulating debates amongst progressive people around the world. She's now the chair of the planning board of the Transnational Institute in Amsterdam, a community of international scholars whose work, both individually and collectively, is intended to contribute to social justice. My friend and colleague, New Internationalist co-editor Richard Swift, was sitting in the interviewing chair when she dropped in. Susan started by outlining factors that are stopping sustainable solutions to the big issues that are facing our world.
It seems to me that it's becoming more and more difficult to do anything lasting under present conditions where we have no democracy at the international level. We have no democracy at the level of the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, the World Trade Organization, and the other large institutions that organize more and more of our lives. And in Europe, we have almost none at the level of the European Commission. There's a very weak parliament which tries to represent citizens but doesn't have the real capability to do so. So, meanwhile, capital is free to do absolutely as it likes, cross borders, go anywhere, not pay taxes, not contribute to citizen well-being anywhere, or less and less when it's transnational capital anyway, which it more and more is, and is making more and more of the decisions that affect our lives. And we're seeing this more clearly now. Perhaps more people are seeing it with the crisis that began with the subprime affair, but which is not limited to that, and which I think is going to get worse and cause a serious recession, at least in some parts of the world.
So the notion that you can have an undemocratic economy and a political system that is democratic, how does that play out?
Well, you can have a political system at the national level, which is at least somewhat democratic, and probably statistically more and more are, particularly since Central Europe has become democratic, and there are at least pseudo elections in various other places like the Philippines, which used to be dictatorships. So yes, we can speak of democracy at the national level, but the problem is that national governments are able to take fewer and fewer decisions about the future of their citizens, and those decisions are taken de facto by actual money management, actual capital flying around the world. That is what decides people's jobs. It's what decides very often their savings, their pensions, their health care or not, their futures, the futures of their children. And we're becoming more and more locked in to the class that we were born in. I see this when I go to America, where I've just been. That used to be the land of opportunity. It used to be the place where in one generation you could go from immigrant to having your children graduate from Harvard. This is absolutely no longer the case. And I think that that is because of international capital, which is trumping international democracy all along the line. And so unless we can fight and win to have democracy at the international level as well, we are going to have less and less freedom. The French voted no on the European Constitution in May 2005. I could give you many reasons for this. It was not an anti-Europe vote. It was an anti-capitalist forever Europe with no possibilities of change. Then what's happened? We said no. The Dutch said no. Now we have exactly the same rules that are coming back in something called a reform treaty, which contains exactly the same provisions, makes us subservient to NATO, talks all the time about the freedom of capital and the movement of goods, capital, services, and people, but says nothing at all about how we might have more democracy at the local level, how we might tax transnational capital, how we might have unified social services. It organizes competition between social services and fiscal systems. And it is exactly the same thing that they proposed before. Now we have to stand up again, 2 years later, and start exactly the same fight under worse conditions than the ones we had in 2005, because then they didn't think we could win. And we did win. And that was a great victory for democracy. But because democracy is hateful, and because 200 and some years is plenty of democracy, and now we should let the technocrats and the business people get on with it, they are putting up the same constitution, which is going to be rushed through with no discussion and no referenda.
So the road to liberation is long, but there's deadlines for survival every morning, is what you're saying, right?
That's right. And every morning when you get up, you know that you have a certain number of tasks. Now, the most recent one that has been placed on our doorsteps, and thank God, in a sense, is climate change. I think people now are way ahead of their governments on this one. And the question that I ask myself is it possible to save the planet under capitalism? And most days I answer, no, it's not. But then, you know, I go on and I think about it a bit more, and then I have more hope and try to change the system so that we can save the planet. So I was remembering what happened during World War II, when, at least in the United States, there was an enormous citizen effort and a conversion of the economy within 6 months or a year to a wartime economy. This was Keynesianism on an enormous scale. It was a moment of great national unity, of great citizen involvement. And I think that we have an opportunity, because the United States is sliding into recession. I think that this is going to be a much more serious period economically than most people realize. They are trying to deal with this recession with the same old tools. A weaker dollar, making U.S. exports cheaper, but there are limits to that. deficit spending, but the deficit is over the top. Households are completely indebted. They have no slack there to keep on using deficit spending. The old tools have been tried. The Federal Reserve says it will reduce interest rates further, but there are limits to that as well. What is the only way you could emerge from a recession? It would be a Keynesian, like John Maynard Keynes, effort to have a wartime economy, but not military this time, but ecological. A huge investment in conversion, a huge investment in public transport, in environmentally friendly energies, in new construction, etc., paid for through carbon taxes, taxes on the movements of capital, taxes on the miles traveled by the clothes we wear or the food we eat to bring production closer to local people. And it could be done, because I think now, certainly in America, people are alarmed, but their governments are very timid. Their political representatives are scared, and they're beholden to the great corporations. But I think that this is a possibility, and it's maybe the only chance we've got. We've got to act now, and we've not got much time. The equation is, can we do what we have to do, and can we do it fast enough under capitalism? I am not trying to save capitalism. That's the criticism you can make. Yes, but if we did what you say, it would give capitalism a new lease on life. That's right, it would, but I don't see how you can have a worldwide revolution so we can convert massively to an environmental economy. I think we can't do anything without the broadest possible alliances. In the movement, you know, people now understand that they can't do it by themselves. They may be environmentalists, but by themselves they can't change the environment. And whereas I would not have said this even 5 years ago, we have to look with business where our concerns overlap. I have got my circle of concerns, they've got theirs. There is some overlap, there's got to be, and I would think saving the planet would be one of those overlaps. I feel that we are in a great state of emergency. I'm frankly scared. It is like World War II. Technically, it's feasible, it's doable, and the prototypes exist industrially for renewable energies, for lighter material. We know how to build ecologically sound, energy-neutral buildings. We know how to do all this. But the thing is that we've got to invest massively in order to do it, and that can only happen with the state and government. But I think it would also be hugely supported by the people and create the same kind of social cohesiveness and a new lease on life for democracy, for that matter, if that can be accomplished.
That's a very interesting platform for which our listeners and our friends to be thinking at the moment, Susan. That was prolific author and progressive thinker Susan George. She's just been presented with the first award of the International Studies Association to an outstanding public scholar. Congratulations, Susan. It was a privilege and a pleasure to welcome you onto our airwaves today.
Good. Nice to talk to you. Bye-bye.
And that interview, conducted last September, concludes our special spotlighting some of the big issues of 2007, issues that are sure to get even bigger in the next few years. So stay tuned. We'll be returning to climate change solutions throughout 2008, starting with a critique on the effectiveness of some of the solutions that we're being asked to put our faith in now: carbon trading and biofuels. That's coming up in a couple of weeks' time. Next week, we're talking about the decline of the US dollar, how it's affecting the world, and what it's got to do with the way President Bush is threatening Iran. Music that we've been playing tonight comes from the Riverboat Records series in the World Music Network's wonderful collection of inspiring music from all corners of the globe. Find out more on the World Music Network's website, www.worldmusic.net or by visiting the New Internationalist website, www.newint.org, which is also where you'll find a copy of this program just waiting for you to download from our audio archives. And iPodders, if you want to subscribe to the program, the New Internationalist website is where it's at. That address again, www.newint.org. Radio New Internationalist is produced at 3CR in Melbourne, Australia, and distributed via satellite on the Community Radio Network. Thanks to the Community Broadcasting Foundation for their financial assistance and the Community Broadcasting Association of Australia for sending this program to a wireless near you. This program's associate producer is Rachel Maher. I'm Chris Richards. Let's talk again soon.